Akiro Kuranami opened his eyes.
Oh, welcome back to us, Lieutenant. You had us all very worried.
What happened?
You were apparently followed by Russian personnel. When you attempted to gain entrance to Dr. Rourke's mountain retreat here, you were struck a blow to the head. Colonel Mann sent us here, anticipating that you might come here. He sent us so that we could help you. It was very fortunate for you indeed that we arrived when we did.
Where, were they?
The Russians? One of them escaped, the other went over the edge of the roadway, falling to his death at the base of the mountain. Can you sit up? We need you to open the inner doors to Dr. Rourke's retreat so that we can use his radio and send for help. Our helicopter was forced down in the blizzard and our radio was destroyed. The Russian who got away has most probably already called for assistance. There's little time to lose.
Roush leaned over Kuranami, gently putting his hands to Kuranami's upper arms.
Let me help you sit up.
Thank you. Elaine, how is she?
Dr. Halverson at last report was perfectly fine. You have nothing to worry about on that score, Herr Lieutenant. Can you stand?
I think so.
Excellent. But remember, should you feel faint because of the blow to the head, just sit down again. We will help you. You can easily tell me the combination to the doors, and we can open them.
All right. But I think I can do it.
Good, Herr Lieutenant. I was told to expect a man of singular courage, and indeed, you are that.
Roush helped Kuranami gradually to his feet. Two other of Roush's eight men supported the young Japanese naval aviator, still wobbly on his legs. Kuranami took slow, hesitant steps toward the doors, Roush's men helping him. At last, he stopped before the doors, nodded, and smiled to the two men. They stepped back a pace. He worked the combination lock on the left.
Two combinations? Was this the customary thing in your time, Herr Lieutenant?
Dr. Rourke is a very cautious man. Mr. Roush, was it?
Yes.
Why isn't it Captain Roush or something?
Roush smiled.
You are quite astute, Herr Lieutenant. I am a member of the top secret group of intelligence commandos recently formed by Colonel Mann. We carry no military rank.
He smiled again.
Although some of us did, I was in fact a major. But we all serve the fatherland in our own way.
Colonel Mann is a fine officer. You are privileged to serve under him.
Kuranami finished the first combination lock and started on the second.
He is an officer whose actions will always be remembered.
Roush did not add why.
Is your gunship disabled?
No, it was forced down, as I said. At least I do not think it is permanently disabled.
If we cannot raise your base on Dr. Rourke's radio, perhaps I can get the helicopter airborne again. I have considerable experience.
As I understand that you do, Lieutenant.
Roush nodded. It seemed that the second combination dial had been turned enough.
Are we ready?
Almost. Is Colonel Mann sending reinforcements?
Oh, yes. When the Soviets attack, they will get more than they planned for, assuredly. I would venture to say, if you are feeling up to it, you will be right there among the heaviest fighting at the controls of your own gunship again.
Kuranami would be dead as soon as he got the doors open and passed inside. Once it was clear that there were no passive defense systems within the doctor's facility, the Japanese's usefulness would come to its sudden, inevitable end.
There.
Now, how do the doors open?
Kuranami looked over his shoulder, reached to the massive handles and jerked them, then pulled the right-hand side door open.
I'll go through first and get the lights.
Yes, a good idea. We will be just behind you, my friend, just behind you.
The Japanese disappeared through the open doorway. Roush reached to his belt for his pistol, nodded to his men. He stepped into the darkness beyond the doors. There were no lights.
Lieutenant?
Move and you are dead.
What is this? To repay our kindness?
If you are who you say you are, step back outside and pull the doors closed and lock them. You will not freeze outside.
Roush felt for a wall somewhere where there might be a light switch.
I will radio for help, confirm your identity, and admit you to wait until help arrives.
But Herr Lieutenant, we cannot do that, I am afraid. I have specific orders to contact my base as soon as possible.
Rausch's hand found a switch. He flipped it.
Kill him!
Nothing happened. No lights. One of his own men fell against him. Rausch fired toward the flash of gunfire.
Bastard!
Rausch threw himself down into the darkness on what felt like stone, his left elbow impacting too hard. His left arm went numb with pain for an instant.
Head out!
Stay outside! Cover the entrance so he cannot slip out!
I have visited Dr. Rock's retreat on several occasions. I know the floor plan. You do not. I have shut off all the lights. You do not know where the circuit panel is. Your only chance is to leave here at once.
No!
Rausch rolled onto his back, then rolled again, groping in the almost total darkness with his left hand. The floor fell away. He panicked momentarily, edged forward, felt a step beneath it.
You are the one who has no options, Herr Lieutenant! My eight men!
Seven! I hit one, Rausch.
Oh, very good! Seven! They have the doorway covered. You cannot leave. If you turn on the lights to get to the radio to use it, you will be shot! Perhaps, as we exchange shots, the radio will be destroyed. I already have what I want. I have captured you and gained access to the Rock's mountain retreat and whatever secrets it may possess.
Who are you?
Rausch smiled. There was no purpose any longer served by lying.
My name is Rausch. I am still a military officer, but of the SS. My men and I are loyal members of the party.
Nazis?
Yes, Kuranami. Nazis. You and your friends and eventually all our enemies will be crushed. Surrender and I promise you a quick and honorable death. You have my oath.
The oath of a Nazi. You must be crazy.
Rausch was tiring of the little verbal battle. He was ready to move. He inched forward, aimed his pistol into the darkness where Kuranami's voice seemed to originate.
Lieutenant?
Yes.
Rausch fired, again and again, the sounds of glass shattering, bullets ricocheting. Then Rausch threw himself over the edge of the steps, wriggling down them on his belly, the base surprisingly near. Kuranami did not fire back.
Lieutenant!
There was no answer.
Kuranami!
Still no answer, but Rausch moved just in case. The only rational thing now was to wait. Sarah felt embarrassed because his body was so close to hers.
Forgive me, Sarah. In these mountains, I was momentarily uncertain of the origin of the gunfire.
He had pushed her against the rocks, sheltering her with his body, the three men with them falling into firing positions around them.
Oh, no. I'm all right, Wolf.
They looked up the road.
I could almost swear those sounds came from the retreat. Where else could they have come from?
Wolfgang Mann's eyes narrowed behind his snow goggles. He activated his microphone.
Ready the aircraft for whatever might arise. Order back one of the J-7Vs from my squadron.
He turned to Sarah.
Sarah, again to be safe, I would like you to wait here.
Two of his men moved along the trail ahead of them, keeping to either side of it, their assault rifles ready. The third man waited with them.
You have not only yourself, but the child you carry to consider, Sarah.
She didn't need him reminding her of that.
What if whatever caused those shots requires knowledge of the retreat to set things right? Even just how to get inside it.
She reached into the pocket of her parka as she removed her right glove, then extracted the Trapper Scorpion 45 the Mulliner boy gave her 5 centuries ago. She worked the slide, chambering the top round out of the 6-round magazine.
As you wish, Sarah, but you must stay beside me.
She raised the 45 safety, clutching the pistol tight in her hand.
All right.
She walked beside him toward the retreat. Akira Kuranami's right hand opened and closed on the butt of the Colt. His own weapon was missing when he awoke, the first clue making him suspicious of his benefactors. Dr. Rourke left a chamber-loaded stainless steel government model Series 80 45 automatic and 2 spare magazines in a niche just inside the door. The good doctor told him of this when Kuranami and Elaine Halverson sought refuge there.
I removed the magazine springs from all 3 of the Colt magazines, then baked them in the oven to properly heat treat them so they would retain the resiliency fully loaded over protracted periods of time. Of course, I also welded the magazine floor plates. The 45 ACP magazines were only spot welded and could come loose from the magazine's body at the worst moments, spilling floor plates, spring, follower, and cartridges, leaving you with an empty gun.
Kurenami remembered all of that. The two spare-loaded magazines were in his pocket. The 45 was still in his fist. And Damien Rausch, this self-proclaimed Nazi, was still inside Dr. Rourke's retreat. Akira would have to fix that. Slowly, not even an inch at a time, he crawled toward the kitchen counter. Between the counter and the couch was the narrowest portion of walking space. The kitchen was up three steps from the great room floor, and Rausch would most certainly have come down the steps, Kurenami hoped. Keeping the steps as a guide, he would move ahead. When he came in line with the couch, that place would be the killing ground. The light that could be activated from within the foyer was on. It was red, and as it washed over the blowing and drifting snow outside the open main entrance door at her family's retreat, it gave everything it touched the color of blood. Sarah crouched beside Wolfgang Mann, his three men now even with them, the 2-point men alerting the colonel that the retreat's entrance was open, that there were an undisclosed number of men inside just beyond the open door.
What do you suggest, Sarah?
She licked her lips beneath the toque she wore to protect her face from the wind.
If you could get one of your men up to either side of the door to cover us, then you and I and your third man, the corporal here, could come up on the blind side from the right.
She gestured toward near the large boulder, now rolled away.
The boulder would give us cover until just at the very end. We could get to the doorway before they saw us. Either that, or it'll turn into a standoff, and it could go on indefinitely.
You could also get shot.
I'm aware of that.
All right, then.
He nodded and gestured commands to his men. Two of them, the point men from before, split to right and left, disappearing almost instantly. But of course, Colonel Mann's personal men would have been among the best of his commandos. She saw Otto Hammerschmidt at work often enough. Otto, her thoughts filled with the fear that she had for Annie, Natalia, and Otto Hammerschmidt. Were they still alive? She felt tears welling up in her eyes.
Are you all right, Sarah?
Uh-huh.
Suddenly, Colonel Mann's 2-point men reappeared, flanking the main entrance to the retreat.
Damn.
She cursed herself for never learning more about the retreat's other entrances. She knew how to use them as exits, not how to enter from outside.
Sarah, we will move ahead now.
Sarah looked at Wolfgang Mann, nodded silently to him, and took off down the trail beside him. She stumbled, caught herself, Mann's hand suddenly at her elbow. They reached the boulder her husband would roll away to begin the entry process to the retreat, what John called their home away from home. She shook her head as a flood of memories awoke. She remembered why she lay in something like a coffin, why there was a smell of gas from within the bedding, why stalactites hung from the ceiling, why a waterfall tumbled at the far end of the great room into a pool. She remembered seeing her son and her daughter grown to maturity, almost the same age as she, and the feeling she'd had against John. She wondered if she still had those, or had she just given up. Was that why he got her pregnant, to say, "Forgive me," or was it simply an accident? But with John Rourke, everything was always planned ahead. She crouched behind the boulder, Colonel Mann beside her on her right, the corporal on her left. His men, who flanked the doorway, advanced. Mann was up, running, saying nothing to her. The corporal beside her stayed still as she started to move. As Colonel Mann neared the door, his two men stepped through, crisscrossing. Colonel Mann raised his assault rifle. Sarah reached the doorway. A man in a white snow smock and holding an M16 raised the rifle to shoot at her. She ducked left, stabbing the little 45 automatic toward him. Colonel Mann stepped in front of her. She almost shot him by accident.
Nazis!
Akira Kurenami saw a blur of movement in the darkness. Kurenami's 45 belched long tongues of flame in the red-tinged darkness. Kurenami felt sudden heat, then cold in his left side. Kurenami heard what sounded like a groan of pain, but he couldn't be certain, so much gunfire from the entrance. He edged behind the kitchen counter, pushed the magazine release button, and ejected the partially spent magazine. It fell to the floor beside him as he put the new magazine up the well. Powerful lights shone from the doorway now. He stabbed the pistol toward one of them.
Akira? Are you in here? What happened to the lights?
It was the voice of Sarah Rourke. The pain in his left side seemed to grow worse, and he rubbed his left hand across his face, then fell forward.
Here!
Two whiskey bottles were shattered, but John would be relieved to know that they were the counterfeit ones made for him by the Germans, rather than containing real Seagram 7. There was a bullet hole in the back of the sofa. There was a bullet hole in the copy of the last issue of Jane's Infantry Weapons, but only near the outside edge. Some of the natural stone was bullet-pocked, but somehow she was sure John would be able to fix that. As for the sofa, Annie was a marvelous seamstress, and if she couldn't repair it, John would just get the Germans to make a new one for him, of course identical to the old one. Heaven forbid anything should be different than he'd originally planned. A German corporal was already sweeping up the glass, while one of the other two men, the other stood guard outside, was cleaning up the spilled whiskey. The kitchen smelled like a distillery with the broken whiskey bottles, and the retreat was freezing cold, but she hadn't asked for the doors to be closed until they were certain there were no more than the eight Nazis. Sarah turned the lights back on from the master panel. The doors would have to be closed soon, or else the light spilling from the open doorway into the night could attract Soviet helicopters if any of their pilots had the nerve to fly in such a storm. Akira Kuranami lay on the floor, a blanket over him and the Afghan Annie crocheted under his head, along with one of the sofa pillows. His eyelids fluttered and opened.
You'll be fine, but don't move. You've got a broken rib unless I miss my guess.
Sarah smoothed his hair back and smiled down at him.
Did I get Rausch, Miss Rock?
We got all eight of them. Now rest, please.
Nine.
Kuranami's eyes closed and his head fell back. She checked his pulse. He was unconscious. His chest began to rise and fall evenly. She realized he hadn't passed out, just fallen asleep.
Sarah, does he speak German?
I don't think so, Wolf. You mean what he said?
Then why is it he said our word for no?
She looked at Kuranami.
Nine men.
The black Marine Spetsnaz uniform was a decent enough fit, although a little tight in the chest. John Rourke closed the belt at his waist, a Sty 20 in the holster. The belt was too loose. He cinched it tighter than the buckle imprint indicated it was usually worn. Beneath the uniform tunic, he wore his two Detonic Scoremaster 45s. He reached into the German gunship from where he stood on the ground in the snow beside the open fuselage and took the 6-inch barreled Model 629, holding it in his right fist for a moment. It was a fine gun, but he missed the Python. In fairness, the caliber was superior for his purposes. He slipped the 44 Magnum between the belt and the tunic, at the small of his back, holsterless, positioned for a cavalry-style reverse draw. He slipped the shoulder holster with the twin Detonics miniguns and the double Alessi rig on, then quickly grabbed up the Soviet outerwear, a parka-like jacket with a poorly designed hood offering no facial protection, too long and too tight for proper freedom of movement. The Soviet forces under the sea would learn the necessities of surface warfare, given half the chance.
I hope they don't get the chance.
He had counted 50 men, all or most of them burned alive, and from the nature of the fire, their deaths were not fast deaths. Perhaps, had he gone straight to the source of the smoke, he might have saved some lives. Rourke left the coat open so he could get to his guns. The LX-10 knife would have to stay behind, but the little Sting 1A black chrome was inside the waistband of his borrowed uniform trousers. Paul approached.
We're all ready!
John nodded as he turned toward the younger man, ran his fingers through the inside of the borrowed uniform cap, and pulled it on.
You look good! Can't close the coat and get to your guns, right? I got the same problem. I figure I can keep the Schmeisser slung so it stays in the small of my back. Not too fast to get to, but I can get away with it long enough.
John Rourke looked at the sky. The snow fell more heavily. He looked at the black face of his Rolex. If he kept his left arm down, no one would spot that until it was too late. He nodded toward Paul Rubinstein, and the two of them walked to where Jason Darkwood, Sam Aldridge, and a Lance Corporal named Lanigan already waited. Somehow, Aldridge talked Darkwood into letting him walk at the rear with his hood up so none of the Marine Spetsnaz unit would see his decidedly African-American black skin. No one could fill out the Soviet sergeant's uniform without looking obviously an imposter, so they decided to have 5 men go instead of 6. The sergeant was simply too big a man. They agreed to let Darkwood do all the talking, since Darkwood's Russian sounded more like the Russian spoken by the Marine Spetsnaz. Rourke's Russian sounded too decidedly 20th century. The situation reminded him of the marked difference between the French language as spoken in Canada and in France.
I enjoyed that helicopter ride, but it scared me half to death. I'll take submarines any day, Doctor.
Darkwood looked at the others.
Gentlemen, shall we? I think we all look very convincing in these rather tacky uniforms. Our public awaits. Showtime.
Darkwood crossed out of the clearing and into the snow-crusted jungle. The column of prisoners, ankles 18 inches or less apart, judging from the shortness of their strides, hands behind their backs, ankles and wrists bound in some sort of plastic restraints, Rourke imagined, slogged down from the highlands to the coast. Through snow that in places looked thigh-deep, not a man among them wore a coat or hat. Either they were stripped of their clothing as a further means of keeping them under control, or whoever was in charge of the Marine Spetsnaz unit herding them toward the island classer enjoyed watching them suffer. The Soviet personnel, on the other hand, were dressed in the same outer gear as Rourke and the other imposters wore. The Soviets looked perfectly warm, though just as weary as their prisoners. John Rourke looked at Jason Darkwood.
Captain Darkwood?
Yes, it's about that time, isn't it?
Hoods up, gentlemen. Don't want Sam Aldridge looking any more conspicuous.
Well, I'll remember this shit if we ever find a colony of Black Russians.
Rourke considered the concept. Pushkin, the famous Russian poet, was, of course, black. Perhaps Aldridge was clairvoyant. Darkwood looked at each of them, then walked out of the trees. Rourke, Paul Rubenstein beside him, right behind Darkwood, then Lance Corporal Lanigan, then Captain Aldridge. Rourke's eyes settled on the head of the column. Snow swirled like desert dust devils, blew in sheets like wind-driven rain. There were approximately 50 of the Marine Spetsnaz. Captain Aldridge's Marine Corps personnel, what few there were in positions of concealment just inside the tree line on both sides of the Marine Spetsnaz unit's line of march. Some would have called five men marching into the midst of 50 heavily armed enemy personnel suicidal. Rourke called it necessary. Rourke slowed his pace, making his steps look more difficult, more laborious, to aid in convincing the Soviet personnel that he and the others had just walked several miles to intercept them. As John Rourke glanced at him, Paul Rubenstein did the same. Lanigan bumped into Rourke, then slowed. Their rifles were slung across their backs, out of easy reach, this to quell any suspicions the Soviet personnel might have. Rourke's left hand kept his coat closed, his right hand swinging free, the drawstring at the waist of the parka pulled tight, the loose end wound to his left fist. When he needed a gun, it would be easier that way. They couldn't use grenades because of the proximity of the prisoners. Once the prisoners realized what was happening, even confined as they were, they might be able to help, but it was more likely some of them would be killed trying. Darkwood signaled a halt. John Rourke clenched the drawstring more tightly in his left fist.
Comrade Captain, our sergeant fell and broke his neck. To have reached him, Comrade Captain, would have meant possible death for us. He was so big.
The Marine Spetsnaz captain said nothing for a moment, eyeing them.
Your name, Corporal?
My name? Yes.
Darkwood turned and looked toward Rourke and the others.
Can you imagine that? He wants my name.
John Rourke cleared his throat.
Excuse me, Corporal. May I give it to him?
Yes. Go ahead and give it to him.
Darkwood nodded, stepping slightly aside. The Marine Spetsnaz captain started to reach for his Sti-20 dart gun. John Rourke ripped his coat back with his left hand and grabbed the Packmeyer-gripped butt of the 6-inch 44 Magnum with his right. Rourke knifed it forward, his right first finger already moving the trigger.
Well, here it is.
Aldridge and the other Marines opened up. Paul Rubenstein took a step forward. He punched one of the Marine Spetsnaz enlisted men in the face, ripped the AKM-96 from his hands, and sprayed it as John Rourke fired the 629 again, taking down a Soviet trooper as he started to fire into the prisoners.
Halt! Let's move!
The 500-year-old pair had done this before. Rourke advanced, then Paul advanced, killing everything they could within the growing gap between their backs. A Marine Spetsnaz enlisted man rushed Rourke on the left, put him down with a single bullet to the throat. A Marine Spetsnaz officer pulled the pin on a grenade. Rourke shot him, and the grenade fell to the ground. Rourke wheeled right, unleashed a double taekwondo kick to the man's right side as he fell, knocking the body down over the grenade.
Grenade!
Rourke threw himself left, slamming one of the Soviet troopers with his body, shooting the man in the chest as they fell. The ground vibrated for an instant. Chunks of body parts, flesh, blood, and bits of bone rained down in the snow. A circle in the snow around what remained of the body lay washed pink as Rourke pushed himself to his knees. John Rourke saw one man with a radio set strapped to his back. If he contacted the island-class submarine, it was all over.
He's mine!
Lork dropped his spent weapons, tore open the front of his tunic, grabbed the Scoremasters, and took off after the retreating radio man. The man with the radio disappeared into the snow-blanketed foliage. Lork charged in after him, got a dozen yards into the jungle, and stopped. He listened, the cocked and unlocked 45s in both raised fists.
This is Proletariat One. Come in, Commander. This is Proletariat One.
The voice was to the right.
Meet the people.
As Rourke broke through the foliage, the Marine Spetsnaz turned around.
No!
The soldier held an AKM-96 assault rifle in his right hand. Rourke's Scoremasters were ready. John Rourke dropped to his knees beside the radio. He picked up the microphone, setting the pistol from his left hand on the corpse, cocked and locked.
This is Proletariat One. Over.
One moment. Proceed.
Rourke almost depressed his push-to-talk button.
This is Commander Stakhanov. What is it, over?
This is Proletariat One. Upon the orders of my commander, I am to advise you all goes well and the column proceeds toward the beach. Proletariat One out.
Stakhanov out.
John Thomas Rourke threw down the microphone. He picked up his gun. Maybe this Stakhanov bought it, maybe not. Soon they would find out. Methodically, Rourke began to strip the man of his coat, uniform cap, and pistol belt, boots, and even the little Sti 20 pistol. When he was all through, Rourke left the dead man in his underwear there in the snow and took the radio. Michael Rourke and his group of commandos moved through the tunnel for more than an hour before the tunnel suddenly began to pitch downward steeply. Michael stopped Bjorn Rolvag. He tried to make himself understood with gestures.
If this tunnel, if it drops like this, where will it end?
Rolvag smiled, patted his dog on the head when it stood on its hind legs beside him. Maria Leuden stepped close to Michael.
Michael, where is this tunnel going?
God knows. And maybe Bjorn and Hrothgar, too.
They continued on. Some of the German commandos and ordinary soldiers reiterated Maria Leuden's question, but no one suggested they turn back. They stopped at Rolvag's insistence, ate, Maria resting her head against Michael's shoulder. When the rest period seemed ready to end, Maria and the men respectively found isolated corners of the tunnel to answer their physical needs, then prepared to go on. But Rolvag signaled with his hands that they should not. Michael just looked at him in the light of their flashlights. Rolvag's eyes were shining. Perhaps the head injury had done more serious damage than anyone suspected.
Hrothgar!
Rolvag pointed at the dog. The big dog sat, its huge tongue hanging out as if it too were somehow mad. Then Rolvag looked at Michael.
Michael!
Michael Rourke wondered if somehow he were supposed to sit too, but Rolvag gestured him ahead.
Maria, wait here.
Please, Michael.
Then stay beside me.
Michael and Maria fell in step behind Rolvag. They walked on that way for what Michael estimated as 100 yards, then the tunnel narrowed. Rolvag turned toward them and raised the first finger of his right hand to his lips in the universal gesture for silence. Michael nodded. Rolvag moved into the narrow portion of the tunnel, Michael after him. Maria moved behind Michael. The tunnel became progressively narrower and the ceiling lower. Michael bent his head slightly before it was really necessary, just the feeling of the tunnel somehow making it smaller, lower. Again, Rolvag stopped.
Light.
Rolvag shut off his flashlight.
Michael, do not.
We've got to play this out. Just hold onto my belt and don't let go.
All right.
Then Michael shut off the light. He could no longer see Rolvag, but felt Rolvag tug at his sleeve. They moved slowly. Michael felt the pressure of Maria's hand at his belt. His coat was open, and he was still warm here. The tunnel made him feel as if he was smothering, even though he was not normally claustrophobic. They seemed to go around a curve in the tunnel, and everything was wider because there was no longer the pressure of the tunnel walls near his shoulders, brushing against his elbows. Michael squinted. As he fully opened his eyes, there was light, the purple lights of the grow lamps of the Hecla community streetlights. The light shone through a crack that looked no more than a few inches wide. Rolvag tugged at him to continue. Maria's hands touched at his neck, and then her hand returned to his belt. They started walking again, almost able to see Rolvag, almost able to see where he was going. The crack of light seemed to grow slightly wider as they got closer. The tunnel curved again, and as Michael came around the curve, he squinted again against the light. The crack was an opening wide enough for a man to pass through sideways. The group sped up its pace. Maria came abreast of Michael and took his left hand. In his right hand, Michael held a Beretta pistol. Rolvag dropped to one knee beside the crack. Michael flanked him, Maria beside Michael. Through the crack, in the purple light, Michael Rohr could see the great park with its greenways, garden paths, burdened with Soviet helicopter gunships and armed guards. Through this tunnel, through this crack in the volcanic cone, Michael Rourke realized he could bring a small army. He had no army. He had his commando unit and the volunteers. Outside in the storm, there were more than 240 German soldiers and technicians. He could get at least half that many and not leave what remained of the German base totally defenseless.
Hitler.
He wanted to tell Rovac his thoughts, wanted to tell him that no, they would not penetrate through the niche of rock now, not when they could bring 100 more fighting men. Rovag looked at him.
Madame Yorkley, my sister, friends, wait me.
Michael looked at him. Rovag took a cylindrical piece of metal from his pouch, touched it to his lips, and blew into it.
What is that, Bjorn?
It's a whistle, Michael.
Hrothgar bounded out of the darkness. Bjorn Rolvag was up, passing through the niche of rock. Michael Rourke reached after him, but the only way to stop Rolvag would have been to lasso him. Michael looked at Maria.
Get the others. Bring them here. Wait for me.
He shrugged out of his jacket, grabbed up his M16, and pushed through the niche, her hands reaching after him. Beyond Michael, along a trail dotted on both sides with beautiful flowers and perennial shrubs, he could just make out Bjorn Rolvag swinging his mighty staff, his dog bouncing at his heels. Michael Rourke followed him. Michael could hear his father's voice warning him not to do something like this. But at the same time, he could see his father, John Rourke, doing exactly the same thing. Because there wasn't really any choice, and he couldn't let Rolvag, who never even carried a gun, do the thing on his own and die. Michael quickened his pace so he could catch up. There were things to do. Vasily Prokopyev reached the end of the sewer tunnel, took off his pack, sat down on the tunnel floor for several minutes to rest while he collected his thoughts. Above him lay the sewage treatment facility, where the exiting sewer water was treated and funneled into special piping systems for industrial cooling purposes. At any moment, a sewer worker might come down into the tunnel system. Prokopyev would not have to kill such a person because the man or woman would be unarmed, simply render him temporarily unconscious. Above him in the treatment plant, there were no armed guards either, but a short distance outside the plant gate stood the westernmost exit from the underground city. It was the smallest entrance exit, used only for industrial purposes. The trucks that now moved freely in and out in the decades since the return to the surface carried out certain industrial wastes to the new chemical factory complex where, it was rumored, new types of gas were being perfected and tested. Beyond the gates, of course, there were military personnel everywhere, but he could blend in there. And there were places where gunships frequently landed. He could steal one. He physically recoiled at the idea of stealing, but there was no hope of reaching the German lines without one. He stood up, pulled on his pack. He checked his weapons, a plan of sorts hatching in the back of his mind. If it worked, he might avoid shedding innocent blood. If it did not, he might die. It was not as if he were not already committed to what he must do. He was. But the doing of it would be the most difficult task he had ever performed in his life. It was necessary to constantly reassure himself he was doing the right thing. As he climbed the ladder, one of the wounds he sustained at the second Chinese city suddenly pained him, and he swung back from the ladder on his good arm. After a few seconds, the pain began to subside. He continued the climb upward. He thought again about the pistol that Comrade Marshall gave him, the sort of pistol a senior officer passed on to a son or nephew who would carry on for him. What went on in the mind of Comrade Marshal Nikolai Antonovich? Why had he, Vasily Prokopyev, been chosen? And what had the Comrade Marshal meant? He remembered the Comrade Marshal's words.
And tell Dr. Rourke this changes nothing. I would kill him if I had the chance, and I will expect the same courtesy from him.
The water was warm as the Pacific was supposed to feel, Rourke supposed, or almost at least. But the air temperature was in such sharp contrast. John Rourke shivered as he put his head above the water, oriented himself on the Soviet island-class submarine as he sucked air, then tucked beneath the surface again. Jason Darkwood offered diving equipment, but as eager as Rourke was to try the wings and pressure suit and hemosponge breathing apparatus, now was not the time. And there were not enough diving suits to go around. Like others, he took his chances without one, surfacing as needed, gulping air, diving beneath the surface again, hoping not to be seen and shot by someone aboard the deck of the island-classer. He swam ahead, his knives his only weapons except for two of the Sti 20 pistols. Paul Rubinstein swam beside and a little behind him. Rourke broke the surface again, gulping air, almost gulping water as a small wave lapped over him, then tucked down again. The hull of the island-classer loomed ahead like something out of a nightmare. When he first saw one, when he and Natalia were kidnapped and brought below the surface, he thought it was that, a nightmare. But the nightmare was only beginning. He looked at the Rolex. Like the rest of the diving team, he had set the locking bezel in synchronization with Darkwood's watch. John Rourke's Rolex read precisely 2 minutes before 8. He broke the surface again, the sky still gray when it should have been a rich blue here. Early evenings in the Pacific were beautiful experiences he remembered well, no longer. He tucked beneath the surface. Rubinstein, swimming beside him, pointed to his watch. Rourke nodded. 1 minute. Darkwood and 24 of the released prisoners, some of the men armed only with sharp sticks, surrounded Rourke and Rubinstein. At precisely 8 in the evening, the remaining 50 or so freed prisoners, some of them wearing the uniforms of their former captors, and the Marine contingent from the Reagan, under the command of Sam Aldridge, now disguised as a prisoner, would begin to board the island-class Soviet submarine Arkhangelsk, which meant that the hull defense and warning systems would be shut off. If they were to take the submarine, there could be minimal shooting. A submarine damaged beyond repair would be as useless to them as no submarine at all. Jason Darkwood tapped John Rourke on the shoulder. It was precisely 8 as Rourke glanced at the luminous face of his watch. Almost as one man, they broke the surface beside the hull of the island-classer. Paul Rubinstein seemed to be stifling a cough. In Paul's right hand, he held his Gerber MK1 fighting knife. Rourke held the Grain Life Support System 10 survival knife in his right fist. He watched Jason Darkwood as Darkwood moved along the hull. Rourke and Rubinstein followed. Darkwood stopped at some sort of cleat in the hull. He looked to his men, right and left, gave a thumbs-up sign, then began to climb. John Rourke swung onto the cleats right behind him and climbed. Paul Rubinstein followed. The cleats were not a ladder, but served well enough as purchases for hands and feet. There was a rail along the missile deck. Darkwood clung to it, roping along hand over hand, his feet only frictioning against the hull. Rourke followed him, his knife in his borrowed web belt. John Rourke raised his head, peered across the missile deck. Some of Aldridge's people were already boarding the island-classer. It was imperative to wait until some of them, at least, were below decks, lest the hatches shut and the submarine dive. Rourke kept moving, nearer to the sail, looking to his left. Half of the 24 men of the boarding party were clinging to the rail, some of the others still on the cleats, fewer than a half dozen still in the water, men with knives bitten hard in their teeth, sharp-pointed sticks thrust through their belts. The men were barefoot, shirtless, like Rourke himself, their bodies dripping wet, the wind like icy tentacles curling around them. Rourke stopped. It appeared that some of the Aldridge party was below decks, but there was some sort of altercation on the missile deck near the boat ladder on the starboard side. Sam Aldridge seemed to be in the middle of it. The Marine captain just stood there, still acting like a cowed prisoner. Lance Corporal Lanigan, now in a Marine Spetsnaz lieutenant's uniform, stood between Aldridge and a naval officer of considerable rank, perhaps Commander Stakhanov from the radio message. Rourke looked to his right. His eyes and Darkwood's met. Rourke looked across the missile deck. Aldridge took a step away as Stakhanov drew a pistol. It wasn't a Sti 20. It looked like a real gun.
Board her!
John Rourke pushed himself up over the rail, his wet trousers sticking to his legs, his hair dripping water across his face, the wind and falling snow freezing him as on bare feet he raced across the missile deck. Lanigan stabbed one of the midwake issue pistols toward the naval officer. The man tumbled back, sprawling across the deck. John Rourke reached out, grabbed one of the crew from behind, spun him around and thrust forward, the LS-10 knife punching into flesh. A junior Soviet naval officer turned to face Rourke, a Sti 20 in his right hand. Rourke moved faster, the LS-10 slashing open the carotid artery, continuing across the throat. Paul Rubinstein was locked in combat with a man nearly twice his size. The man swung a fire axe. Paul ducked under its arc, lunged with a Gerber knife into the axe-wielding man's abdomen, pulled it out, then stabbed in again. He fell to his knees as the man tumbled forward over him. Then Paul was on him, raking the knife across the man's throat. John Rourke started for the sail. Gunfire rained down from the rail at its height. Rourke sheathed his knife and jumped for the ladder leading to the top of the sail. As Rourke climbed, the rifleman above him leaned over the railing, taking aim.
John! Swing right!
Rourke looked back. Paul Rubinstein, shirtless and dripping wet, smiled, holding the Soviet commander's pistol in his right hand. Rourke swung back to the ladder and took the rungs as quickly as he could. He vaulted over the rail and was on the sail. A yard from his feet, the main hatch was closing. To his left, a Soviet seaman rushed him with a monkey wrench. John Rourke sidestepped right, then rammed the grain knife forward into the seaman's throat. Rourke brought his left fist to the knife. Rourke swung the sailor around, hurtling the body off the knife and lodging the dead boy between the hatch and the deck. On the deck near Rourke's bare feet was the AKM-96 that a moment ago had been aimed at him. He picked it up, stabbed the muzzle of the AKM-96 under the hatch. The sailor's body was being crushed, blood spurting from it. Rourke fired, spraying out the contents of the magazine into the space below. He left the rifle wedged beneath the hatch, then reached to it, throwing his body weight against the hatch. Suddenly, Paul was beside him, then Jason Darkwood.
Wait a minute!
Paul grabbed a second AKM-96 from the deck and fired it out beneath the hatch. Suddenly, the downward pressure on the hatch eased, reversed.
We're secure below! Jace, get more men down here!
As the hatch raised, Rourke, then Paul Rubinstein, and Jason Darkwood simultaneously started down. Bodies of Soviet seamen and Americans from Midway lay everywhere. Blood seeped from a wound in Aldridge's right shoulder.
The bridge is secure, and so are the torpedo rooms. Time's on our side now.
Aldridge started down into the bowels of the island classer. Rourke took the ladder down, skating it, crashing, dropping to his knees. Then John and Paul ran after Sam Aldridge.
The ship is ours!
Jason Darkwood ran toward the bridge. The fighting below decks consumed another hour, scouring every berth and cabin, every possible space for Soviet personnel. Those who surrendered or were captured alive were allowed to live. They were put ashore with provisions and a radio. The radio was in pieces, so it would take several hours to make it work again, enough time for Darkwood to pilot the island classer out of harm's way. They waited for dawn. The snow finally slowed, nearly stopped. There was a crack in the horizon, sun bleeding beneath it across the sea. Above the sail, some of Aldridge's Marines raised the American flag. John Rourke stood beside Paul Rubinstein. It was cold. The wind blew fiercely as the flag stiffened and snapped. John Rourke watched it for a long time. Things were turning around. He could feel it. Beside him, Paul Rubinstein shed silent tears. Survivalist The Struggle is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1989, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2009, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Mort Shelby, Dylan Lynch, Jeff Baker, Sonny Lasky, David Coyne, Christopher Graybill, Eric Messner, M.B. Van Dorn, Michael Glenn, Ren Casey, Tony Nam, Ken Jackson, Thomas Penny, Lily David, Richard Rowan, Stephen Carpenter, Tom Simpson, Elizabeth Jernigan, Michael John Casey, and Nanette Savard. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Timothy Lynch. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Temeskin Wubna. Adapted for graphic audio by Timothy Lynch. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for writer Stacy's Doomsday Warrior, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another action-filled title in Graphic Audio.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
What is your name?
Anya Creed.
I see.
Who are you?
My name is Agamemnon. We have your passport here.
They took it from me when I was kidnapped.
We will videotape your beheading and then broadcast it all over the world.
Beheading?
Are you afraid to die?
I faced death before.
I will kill you!
Don't move. Who are you?
My name is Anya Creed. The Abu Sayyaf kidnapped me several days ago. I have no idea where I am.
You live here, or are you just passing through?
Gunnery Sergeant Vic Gutierrez, United States Marine Corps.
Something bothering you, Vic?
I got this feeling like someone's keeping an eye on us.
Excuse me!
What happened?
Anya, wake up and pay attention.
Where are we?
You are in a cavern located far beneath the surface of the jungle. You're wasting your time. You would need to be a lot stronger than you are in order to break free. Besides, you are to be sacrificed to our god.
I don't believe you.
Very well. You believe now, don't you?
Oh, great.
Oh, crap. Rogue Angel 18. Sacrifice. In Graphic Audio.
If you can't find that Graphic Audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets that include 5 books of a series, available only at www.graphicaudio.net.